How pleasant, bobbing along on the bottom of the beautiful briny sea. What a chance to get a better peep at the plants and creatures of the deep. We glide far below the rolling tide, serene through the bubbly blue and green. It's lovely bobbing along on the bottom of the beautiful briny sea.
Good afternoon. It's every other Sunday again, and the 20th day of the Great Hunkering Down. Welcome to Sustainability Now, a biweekly program focused on environment and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz. I hope all of you are doing well. Since everybody is shut in, today we're going to take a trip down to the beach and beyond, because my guest is KSQD sound engineer Emily Dunham. Emily's a fifth-year PhD candidate in ecology and evolutionary bio at UC Santa Cruz. Her research focuses on how sea urchins, which graze on kelp forests, may be vulnerable to ocean acidification and global warming. Emily is also the producer of Santa Cruz Naturalist, which airs on Tuesdays at 7:54 a.m., Wednesdays at 3:55 p.m., and Saturday at 11:54 a.m. She's also a diver and photographer, and her favorite crustacean is the horseshoe crab. So let's begin. Briefly, Emily, tell us, what is the focus of your research?
Hi, so thanks, Ronnie, for having me. It's funny, I hadn't remembered that I put that on my website about the horseshoe crab.
You put a lot there.
I did, yeah. Thanks for having me here. So my research, just kind of big picture broadly, is trying to understand how kelp forest ecosystems are going to respond to global change. And when we were talking about global change, you know, for the most part, I think people are pretty familiar with warming, global warming. You know, it's happening on land, it's happening in the water. You know, for marine ecosystems, some of the kind of, canaries in the coal mine for warming are corals. And I think that a lot of people are really familiar with some of the consequences for corals, but other organisms also respond to temperature. In fact, we ourselves do. I mean, we can think about how we, you know, sweat on a warm day. And then the kind of what has been termed the evil twin of global warming is actually ocean acidification. And I think people are a little bit less familiar with ocean acidification, although public literacy is increasing. So that's a great thing. But essentially, our oceans are becoming more acidic, and that's happening due to this increased atmospheric CO2 that is dissolving into the ocean surface waters. And here in California, the seawaters are actually acidifying at roughly twice as fast as other regions of the ocean. So this is actually a hot spot for ocean acidification in the California Current. So it's actually a really great place to be studying climate change, because we really need to get a handle on what those ecosystems are going to start to look like in the future.
So you're studying the kelp forest grazers. What are those?
So when I say the word grazer, those are just kind of the organisms that are eating all the plants, right? And in the oceans, those are the guys that are eating the seaweeds. So, you know, in terrestrial ecosystems, you can think of those as the things like cows, and it can range from everything from mammals down to insects and things, right, that are eating all the plants. In the oceans, it's largely, or specifically in kelp forests, it's largely invertebrates. It's things like sea urchins and snails. So they're not quite as charismatic as some of the land or terrestrial grazers are, but I hope by the end of our conversation, you'll feel like they are just as important as I think they are.
Well, before we go on, because, you know, I have a bunch of questions here. How did you get into this business?
Well, so I'm actually from the Midwest. I'm from Ohio, and
Not many urchins there.
There are not many urchins. And actually, I first saw the ocean when I was in my teens. So I was not, you know, I talked to a lot of students in my program and people will say that, you know, they're in marine science because they grew up next to the water and appreciated the water their whole life. And I would say that I have appreciated it as the ocean as long as I have known it. But my kind of curiosity for ecology, which is what I study, really started in my childhood exploring like a lot of the bugs in my neighborhood. So I kind of always was really interested in nature. And when I was just about to graduate from high school, my parents, they encouraged me to get scuba certified so that I could come on a trip with them. So I was 17 or 18 when I first went scuba diving for the first time. And it was just this amazing experience where I realized that I had kind of transported into like almost, you know, a new universe.
Where was that?
It was actually in the Caribbean.
Okay.
Yeah. So then I had applied to the University of Hawaii to go to university, and it was kind of on a whim. And after that experience, I decided that it was something I would like to pursue just to be closer to the ocean and experience something completely different. And it was probably my sophomore or junior year that I realized that there were a lot of opportunities in marine science and people were actually making careers out of being a marine scientist, which just seemed totally crazy to me. And I got involved in some labs. And that really got me familiar with some of the different, you know, professions that exist. But it wasn't until actually I graduated from undergrad and I started working as a contractor for NOAA, and I was doing some coral reef monitoring work where we would go out on these research cruises to really remote islands and atolls, and we would do surveys of the reefs. And these were just to kind of to have baseline data on how many fish, what types of fish live in these different places. So these were really just like like baseline information on these coral reefs. And we went to this island called Howland Island. And most people would know about Howland, or if you've heard of Howland, you would probably know that that was where Amelia Earhart was.
Right.
That would probably be the only reason that most people would know of Howland, but that's where she was trying to head to before she disappeared. So it's this tiny island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, virtually untouched by humans. So it's a really, really pristine reef. And I remember being on my first dive, and it was one of the first dives that I did with this group, which I went on to go to some really fantastic places after that, but this was the first really pristine place that I went to, and it just like blew my mind. I was just like so blown away by the schools of fish and the beautiful corals. And then I got up and we went on the backside of the island, and everybody was talking about how this was this amazing coral reef, and I jumped in, and all of the corals were bleached. So what I mean by that is that they were all white. And so what happens with corals when they get stressed out is they actually expel so they actually have a symbiotic relationship with algae called zooxanthellae, and they actually expel those. And those zooxanthellae are really important because they actually give the coral food. So without them, they can't survive.
Mm-hmm.
And so this whole reef was just bleached. And what ended up happening is that there was like a localized warming event that happened just around that area. It wasn't like all across the Pacific, and it caused this island to have this massive bleaching event. And it was after that that I really started to realize that these places that are completely, you know, virtually, you know, quote unquote, untouched by humans are still going to be really heavily impacted by us. And after that, I kind of decided that I wanted to move into studying climate change to try to understand so that's kind of how
that's how you ended up in Christy Coker's lab?
Yeah. I mean, I did do a master's before that.
But
that's kind of how I ended up in Christy's.
It's the climate change angle rather than the marine science angle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. And I would say that I'm first and foremost an ecologist and then kind of a climate change biologist.
Uh-huh,
beyond
uh-huh,
that, uh-huh. But then a marine biologist kind of you know.
Yeah.
So, after that,
so a lot of skills there. So let's talk about the kelp forest. Most of us only know kelp from what washes up on the beach, particularly after storms. You know, so kids play with them. As I was telling you earlier, I once took a kelp root apart with my kids and found all kinds of critters living in there. But of course, they have this life cycle offshore. So what are they exactly?
Yeah, so kelp forest, this is actually one of the things that I think is really neat about talking to most Californians, is they do actually interact with kelp. They have some sort of intuition for what a kelp forest might be, because anybody that goes onto the beach is going to see it, you know, washed up. Which is actually really, really cool. You know, you don't really get that on coral reefs, for mm-hmm. instance. But yeah, so a kelp forest is essentially an ecosystem that is created by this massive seaweed called kelp. And there are a bunch of different species or types of kelp. Here in California, there are kind of, or in central and up into Northern California, there are kind of two main species that form... that form the forests. The one that is most common down here is called the giant kelp. Mm-hmm. And that's the one that you tend to see off West Cliff and most areas in town.
Yeah.
If you go up to Davenport, you're going to see a different type of kelp, and that's called Nereocystis or bull kelp. And that's a slightly different experience to even be in a Nereocystis bed compared to a Macrocystis. So there are a couple of different types of species of kelp that actually form forests. But essentially what a kelp forest is it's the habitat that is created by these massive plants that can grow to be, 30, 40, sometimes even 50 or 60 feet tall. So they can be mm-hmm. really, really big. Mm-hmm. And the kelp itself is not all that the kelp forest is, right? They actually create habitat for really, really diverse assemblages of different critters and other seaweeds. So the kelp actually create that, but the kelp forest itself is so much more than just the kelp.
What is the life cycle of the kelp then? Because what we see on the beach is only a very small fraction, right? So the question I'm asking is, do individual plants die? Or, you know, so how long do they live? It's not something that I think anybody who isn't an expert on it knows.
Yeah, yeah. So kelp, an individual does die. Yeah, so the way that it works is you can think of a kelp, we'll call them plants. That's kind of what the, you know,
we call
them.
Like a tree, right?
Yeah. Exactly. It's like a tree, right? Yeah. And that root system that you were talking about is called the holdfast. Mm-hmm. So each, you know, plant has its holdfast. And when that plant gets ripped up because a big storm comes along, for instance, that plant dies. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's all that it is. But the way that they reproduce is actually pretty fascinating. So I'm going to try to describe this. It's much easier to draw. But essentially what you have with a kelp plant is you have this massive structure at the base that attaches it. This is the holdfast. And that looks almost like a net of tendrils. Right. And usually it's kind of formed around a rock or something. So I imagine you might maybe remember when you picked the holdfast up. It was, you don't remember, but sometimes
it was a big one. I mean, it was about a foot or so across. We never got into the middle of it.
Yeah, yeah. So they usually will be kind of attached, and they need to have something hard to attach to, okay? Uh-huh. And then the plant, from there, it will have these blades, and they're called sporophylls, okay? And they're kind of thin blades. You can almost think of them as long leaves, and they're at the base of the plant, very close to the seafloor. And those plants actually contain the spores that get released to then create new kelp plants.
Okay.
And so those
okay.
are at the base of the plant. And what happens is they just kind of, they get kind of shaken off, and there will be thousands of them that get shaken off. Okay. And then I guess I'll just, before I go back to that, to what happens after the spores are released, I'll just kind of describe the rest of the plant real quickly.
Why don't we take a, it's time to take a break. So let's do that. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org on the internet. Tune in to KSQD Tuesday mornings at 7 for Climate One, produced by the Commonwealth Club. Climate One is a forum for candid discussion among climate scientists, policymakers, activists, and concerned citizens, with a focus on energy, the economy, and the environment. Climate One airs Tuesday mornings at 7 and alternate Mondays at 6 p.m. here on KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. On Tuesdays, Climate One is followed by Santa Cruz Naturalist, produced by our guest today, Emily Donham, and then by Democracy Now! So you're listening to Sustainability Now, and my guest today is Emily Donham, who is our sound engineer as well as a PhD student in ecology and evolutionary biology up at UC Santa Cruz. And we've been talking about kelp forests, and you were starting to tell us how they reproduce.
Yeah, so these spores that are at the base of the plant, they get released, and what happens is actually these are microscopic little spores, and they get deposited and they onto the seafloor, and they have to be very, very close together in order for them to actually create an individual. Because what happens is the female spore, so they're male and female spores. The female will release a pheromone in the water, and the male has to be able to sense that in order to release sperm to fertilize the egg from the female. So it's actually pretty fascinating that there's scent involved in this plant process in water. I find that really fascinating.
And that spores are operate like that, huh?
I have
no idea.
Yeah. Okay. Anyways, so that's kind of how their life cycle goes.
So we were talking earlier about kelp forest grazers. So what do they actually do?
Yeah, so kelp forest grazers can be really, really important in kind of structuring the ecosystem. So they can actually help to, for instance, open up space on the reef. So if you imagine this reef, it's a really, really busy place out there, and there isn't much bare space to grow. So there are a lot of organisms that need hard substrate to actually grow on, but there isn't a lot of that available. And so a lot of these grazers, they come along and they'll munch down on the various plants, and sometimes even animals. They'll accidentally eat some of the little animals and stuff. And that will open up some bare space for something else to then grow on. So they can actually help to open up bare space for organisms to recolonize. They also can have really, really big impacts. So that's kind of something that can be, you know, pretty beneficial. And, you can think of that as maybe a little bit of a smaller scale effect. But one of the kind of quintessential examples of the impacts of grazers is this transition from a kelp forest to an urchin barren. Have you ever heard of this?
I've heard a little bit about the disappearance of the kelp forest and the but why don't you tell us about this?
It's something that's pretty relevant right now, because we're actually seeing a fair amount of this happening. So what can happen sometimes is if there are a lot of, for instance, sea urchins, they're pretty voracious. They eat a lot. If there are a lot of sea urchins, they can actually graze down all of the kelp in an area to the point where it becomes completely devoid of kelp. And then if their densities are so high, every time that a kelp starts to grow, because as I mentioned before, there are these spores on the reef, right? So there are potentially propagules from which new kelp can come back from. Every time that one of those starts to grow, these urchins will eat that. So that's something that is kind of currently an ongoing issue here in Central and Northern California.
Yeah, I sort of remember reading about divers going down and trying to thin out the urchins.
Yeah.
But don't urchins have any predators? Aren't they prey for anything?
Yeah, so they do have some predators. And so that's actually part of the complexities of this issue with the urchin barrens. So back in, I think it was 2012, we had this massive disease that came along called sea star wasting disease.
Right.
And it decimated a lot of the sea star populations all along the coast. And in particular, the sunflower sea stars are really, really big predators of urchins.
Yeah.
And so in addition to the dramatic loss of these sea star predators, We also actually just had a really good year for sea urchins. So, you know, you can think about every year a certain number of small urchins are going to be born. Right. And there just happened to be a really, really good year for urchins. So it's kind of this two-fold thing.
But if you've got a barren, doesn't that mean that there's no food and they're going to die?
So part of the problem is that urchins can live a very long time without eating. They can live for years without eating.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, so it's very difficult. The other piece that's kind of interesting is that one of the first examples of a kelp forest transitioning into an urchin barren actually happened up in Alaska in the Aleutian Islands. And part of why this happened was because we had actually, humans had removed all the sea otters for the fur trade.
Mm-hmm.
And when they reintroduced them, then those sea otters actually were able to keep the urchins in check enough that the kelp forests were able to recover. And so some ongoing research actually at UC Santa Cruz, that is not my research, but I actually had the pleasure of interviewing a grad student working on this for my naturalist show. One of the problems, or one of the questions that people have been having, is sea urchin populations are really, really high in the Monterey Bay, like higher than they've ever been, but we're still having this issue. And part of the problem is that sea urchins, they just weren't eating as many, or sea otters were just not eating as many sea urchins because they actually specialize on different prey.
They prefer other things? I mean, is that the idea, or?
Different families of sea otters will actually specialize on different prey. So every sea otter isn't eating sea urchins.
Uh-huh.
So that's kind of part of the interesting
sort of sea otter culture. Food culture.
Sea otter food culture.
That certainly is a topic for Santa Cruz, right? Which is where food is so important. Well, you're studying the energetics of sea urchins. And so what does that mean?
Yes.
And grazers. What exactly? Chris Wilmer was here and said, I mean, you probably remember him, right? Talking about mountain lions, and mountain lion energetics came up as well, as I recall. So what are sea urchin and kelp grazer energetics exactly?
Yeah. So I'm using energetics. So I guess I should say, the energetics part is not nearly as interesting to me as then how it feeds into the ecology. Okay, so I'll just start by saying,
that,
yeah.
You know.
So the energetics is really, you can think of it as how energy flows into and through an organism. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably kind of the easiest way to think about it. But in reality, the way that I like to explain it to people is that I am like helping with the dieting of these urchins, right?
Right,
because
sure.
I'm pretty much keeping track of how many calories they're bringing in, and then how many calories they're burning. And it gets a little bit more complex than that, or than we might think of with humans, because I'm not necessarily interested in, you know, for a human, you can think of yourself as burning calories just like by maintaining yourself, right? Like you're just sitting in place and you're breathing and you're burning calories, digesting food, and then you're probably going to deposit some of that as fat. Well, urchins don't have a lot of fat, but I can quantify how many of their calories they're using to just maintain their bodies. And then I can also measure how many calories they're putting into some of their reproductive organs, which is what is really, really important for their kind of persistence over time. And it's also the thing that's really important to people that eat sea urchins, or animals that eat sea urchins, because the part that is so delectable is their gonads, or their reproductive tissue.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so I quantify all of these different pieces to try to understand how changes to their environment, things like if I, you know, turn up the temperature a little bit, or I acidify the water, how that actually changes the checks and balances of that budget. So are they going to, for instance, if, you know, it becomes more intense to just sustain your body when you are in a warmer environment that's more acidic, are they going to then eat more in order to bring in more calories? Or are they going to have to maybe change the way that they're allocating those calories within their body? So maybe they don't, you know, you can think of it as, for instance, let's say that they decide that they can only, you know, allocate, you know, 75% of the calories that they usually did to build their gonads, then, you know, that other 25% is going to go to something else, right? And so the thing that I'm really interested in is, well, if those gonads are only 75% of the size that they were, what does that mean for the whole community? Or if they're eating, you know, 10% more food than they had before, what does that mean when you have a, you know, 1,000 urchins eating 10% more food than they did before on the reef?
Well, how do you measure that stuff?
So, you know, it actually is way more simple than it might seem. So, you know, you can measure how many calories are in seaweed,
right,
by using something called a bomb calorimeter. There's also just some kind of general conversions you can make. Mm-hmm. And then I will measure their metabolic rates, and you can also transform that into calories.
How do you do that?
So the way that I measure their metabolic rates is I take an urchin and I will put it into a small chamber. And within that chamber, I have a little sensor, and that sensor will measure the amount of oxygen in that vessel. And then I close that vessel up so there's no gas exchange. So any changes in oxygen have to be due to that sea urchin breathing that oxygen. And then I can measure that multiple times and calculate a rate from it. So that's how we do it. It's a little simpler.
Yeah, no, I was trying to imagine how you would, you know, do you weigh them, you know, every morning the way that we weigh ourselves every morning or something like that.
Yeah.
You mentioned a couple of weeks ago that you've got, you know, you have to go up to campus even though it's closed to take care of your sea urchins. So, what's the care and feeding?
Yeah, so it's actually pretty simple. But I guess maybe real quickly, I'll just say that, you know, I think maybe one of the things people wouldn't necessarily realize is that some people do have animals and experiments that were planned and now they're kind of put on hold. So I actually had a bunch of animals that I had collected for an experiment that are now just kind of sitting there, and now I'm just kind of taking care of them. But it's actually pretty easy. So in our lab, we actually have seawater so this is just fresh seawater that comes in from, you know, it's there's a massive pipe that is just off West Cliff down at the Long Marine Lab, and that draws in seawater that's, you know, directly from the ocean, and that gets pumped right into a bunch of tanks where I have the urchins. And so that's water that tap along that seawater, and it's pretty much constantly on. So that water is being recirculated all the time. And then I go out and I actually collect kelp from nearby, and I feed it to them. And they're pretty voracious. You know, I pretty much just give them the kelp fronds and they're happy.
Happy as far as we know, right?
As far as we know,
we don't really know intellectually or philosophically what constitutes happiness for a sea urchin. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org on the internet.
A social distancing tip.
Putting distance between yourself and others is critical to slowing the spread of coronavirus. So here are ways to stay in contact without the physical contact part. Call, send a text, set up a video conference, post on social media, dedicate a song on the radio. If you have symptoms of fever, dry cough, and shortness of breath, call your healthcare provider before going to their office. For more info, visit coronavirus.gov.
Let's all do our part, because we're all hashtag alone together. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Well, hello, everybody. This is Sustainability Now. It's a Sunday evening. I'm in the studio with Emily Dunham, a fifth-year graduate student in ecology and evolutionary biology up at UC Santa Cruz, and we're talking about the beautiful briny sea. How much longer do you have your fifth year? So when are you done?
Ronnie, you know that's not a nice question to ask.
Oh, I know it's not a nice question to ask, but I was just curious.
You don't
have to answer it, okay? So. you mentioned that people like to eat the gonads of sea urchins. Is the particular species of sea urchin we have here delectable to anyone?
Yes, actually. So the species of sea urchin that I study is the red sea urchin, and mm-hmm. it is called Strongylos centrotus franciscanus.
Remember that, everyone. There'll be a quiz.
So it's red sea urchin, uh-huh. and those are actually the ones that that are used in sushi. That's uni. That's what, you know, it's commonly referred to as. And there used to be a fishery. I'm not really super up to speed on the fishery sorts of dynamics, but yes, the red sea urchins are the ones that people eat. And
that would seem to be a solution to the urchin barrens, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so this is part of the thing is, so red sea urchins get really, really big, and that's why their gonads also get really, really big, and so that's why people like to eat them. But the main barren forming species are the purple sea urchin.
Oh, okay.
And those are the ones that are super, super abundant, which red sea urchins are also much more abundant than they usually are. But the purple urchins are the ones that are really barren forming species, and they don't get nearly as big.
Okay.
However, I do know that there is some work down at Moss Landing Marine Labs where they're trying to feed them and see if they can get them to be delectable.
So we would end up with urchin farms, huh? Something like that. I mean,
maybe.
you'd have to somehow keep them penned up, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk some about the acidification and the warming of the ocean more broadly. What exactly does acidification do? I mean, more carbon in the water, calcium carbonate, obviously, which is what creates the shells of all of these critters, is very important, right? But what happens with acidification? Does it stop that particular cycle? Does it, you know, does the calcium carbonate dissolve? It's been a long time since I've done any chemistry, so.
Yeah. So what happens is when that CO2 dissolves into seawater, it actually interacts with water molecules, and it creates this really weak acid called carbonic acid. Mm-hmm. And because it's really weak, it quickly dissociates, and what you end up with is another form of inorganic carbon, which CO2 is a type of inorganic carbon, and hydrogen molecules. And then another consequence of this change is that the molecule, one of those building blocks for calcium carbonate that you just mentioned, which is just for people that maybe aren't as familiar, calcium carbonate is the main mineral that is in shells and skeletons of a lot of marine organisms, and actually in particular the ones that I study. So
and for those of us in Santa Cruz, it's what we live on top of.
Oh yeah, yep.
Limestone,
exactly. Yeah,
and marble.
Yep, exactly. And so one of the building blocks of calcium carbonate is the carbonate ion. And as the pH of the oceans get lower because there's more CO2, that carbonate actually does, it also transforms into a different ion. And this is just this is just basic chemistry. So we do end up with less carbonate ions. So there's less of those building blocks available to build those calcium carbonate shells and skeletons for these critters. And so... It's not that that calcification that we don't have organisms building shells and skeletons. It's that they're going to be doing it at a much slower pace,
mm-hmm.
and then we will see potentially faster dissolution. So some organisms might actually have some of their shells, for instance, dissolve more readily than they would before.
How does this affect your grazers?
So my grazers. Actually, some of them, the snails, they actually build their shells, and those are calcium carbonate shells.
Uh-huh.
So they actually actively calcify.
Uh-huh.
And then the urchins, their skeleton is called a test, And it is also made of calcium carbonate.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So okay. So both of these guys, and also they, the urchins also have spines in those.
Yes. Well, that's.
Yeah, those
that's
are
what
also...
we all know from touch tanks and the
yeah,
like. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. Those are also made of calcium of uh-huh. calcium carbonate. So these guys are susceptible to ocean acidification because of that.
I see.
And largely
okay.
because of that. Yeah.
And does so you also mentioned the warming of the oceans. Now, I was going to say when I go down to the beach, when I'm allowed to go down to the beach these days, and I stick my foot in the ocean, it's not very warm. So, you know, when we talk about warming, what exactly are we talking about? And maybe you could say something about the Humboldt Current as well in all of this, right? Don't we get the Humboldt Current? Isn't that what we get down here? Maybe, well, it's okay. It's just, I can say something about it, right?
But yeah, you could say something about the Humboldt Current.
Well, you know, but the reason that we don't have warm beaches like they do down in Southern California is that there's a trans-Pacific cold current that turns south at, I think it's at Point Mendocino. And that's why the Monterey Bay is such a lively place, because you get cold water upwelling, and that's where all the nutrients are, right? And warm mm-hmm. water doesn't provide that kind of those kinds of nutrients. I mean, that's what I've sort of gathered over the years, right? I mean, this is not my field at all, but I think that's right.
Yeah. So the California Current does.
Yeah, California Current.
Yeah, it does okay. flow southward.
Yeah.
That is true. And down in Southern, this is also not my field. My field is not oceanography. But down in Southern California, you can have a weakening of that. And then that can allow the countercurrent to come up and yeah. bring warmer water from that's yeah. equator, from the equator. But yeah, so we do have cold water and we do actually have a lot of upwelling that happens here. So when we talk about global warming, we're often talking about global prediction. So these are things that are happening, you know, these are kind of averages that are, right. you know, averaged over very large, you know, the whole planet. So generally we have seen warming of approximately 1 degree. 1 degree Celsius, and the predicted kind of changes into the future are an additional 2 to 4 degrees Celsius
right.
By the end of the century.
Mm. Does yeah go on.
Oh, and we do expect warming to happen here, but there's also some yeah.
Does the warming affect then the kelp and the grazers?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so
yes.
So how?
Yes. So temperature is actually...
That's what I was fishing for.
Oh, okay, yeah. So temperature is considered to be kind of this... so we have a really good... In ecology, we have a pretty good handle on how temperature affects organisms. Generally speaking, temperature is going to increase a lot of the things that we think of. So it's going to... increase their growth rates. It's going to increase their metabolism, potentially their grazing rates. It's going to increase a lot of the different performance metrics that we have up until a point, right? So a little bit of warming is probably going to be okay. Maybe in some places, a moderate amount of warming is going to be just fine too. But then extreme warming is going to push organisms beyond this threshold, after which it's just really, really quite bad. And you see a pretty big decline in these performance metrics, right? So you can think of things that temperature as kind of increasing up until a point. Now, that one of the problems is that some organisms are actually kind of living pretty close to that threshold, right? So a little bit of warming can actually push them over that threshold. So here in Central California, in some of the experiments that I've run on my grazers, a little bit of warming, it doesn't have really dire consequences. But if you think about that little bit of warming happening to every individual, and if that little bit of warming increases their grazing just a little bit, that actually can really scale yeah. up.
I mean, how much warming are we talking about then? I mean, what's the band in which they thrive, and then what's the temperature at which they start to... This starts to become a real problem. Do you know?
You know, I don't know what that is for my urchins. What I can tell you is that the temperatures fluctuate, you know, in the kelp forest from, I'd say, like maybe a minimum of maybe 48 degrees Fahrenheit is kind of the colder on the colder end up until 60.
Oh, that
when
much.
Things get up to being kelp really like cool water, and in particular they really like that cool nutrient rich upwelled seawater. But they don't do very well when it gets warm. And so in El Nino years, you'll actually see the kelp die back quite a bit because they just don't do as well under warmer temperatures. So it varies, right? This is a very species specific sort of thing.
Kelp have chlorophyll in them, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they're also getting nutrients out of the water, mineral nutrients. I mean, is that what, when you say they get, you know, nutrients out of the cold water, we're talking about mineral nutrients then, presumably, of something like that.
Yeah.
And not organic nutrients.
It's primarily things like nitrate. So the chlorophyll actually is light harvesting, right? So that's harvesting light. And then in order to kind of make carbohydrates, they need light and nutrients.
Right. Yeah.
And water. So,
okay.
So they need all of those things. Yeah.
Okay.
And nutrients can sometimes be limiting.
What other kind of research goes on in Christy Coker's lab?
You know, there's a lot of different things going on. Everything has this kind of overarching kind of global change biology,
right.
Or it's under this global change biology umbrella. But
is it all marine?
Or yes, it's all marine. I'm thinking about it. Yeah, everybody is marine, but people are just like, we're all over the place in terms of the system and types of critters that we study.
Uh-huh.
So, for instance, we have, we kind of have a satellite lab up in Sitka, Alaska. Uh-huh. And that's actually a really, really neat kelp forest ecosystem that is up there. So we have one PhD student that lives up there, and she studies seaweeds up uh-huh. in Sitka. And specifically a lot of the calcifying seaweeds that are called coralline algae, as well as a number of kelp species that are actually not these really tall habitat forming ones, but they're ones that sit more flush to the seafloor. Those are also food for a lot of grazers up there. Mm-hmm. So she's kind of studying a lot of the seaweeds up there. And then there's another student named Jason Toy, and he studies evolution in a surf perch, which is a species of fish that we have here in California, but it its range is from down in Baja, Mexico, up until, I think, up in Alaska, close to Sitka is kind of the range of this fish. So he's kind of trying to ask these, like, questions about evolution.
What kind of questions can you actually research over the length of a PhD? Evolutionary questions, I'm just curious.
Oh, well, I mean, there are a lot. So, you know, contemporary evolution is a thing. And that's kind of evolution that is detectable over these short time scales.
Is it like adaptation to changing conditions
You should give him
I'll have to follow up on him and ask him about it.
Stuff is very, very interesting. He's asking a lot of questions about how using different populations and kind of seeing how they differ uh-huh. within the same species.
Uh-huh.
So, but then there's another student that's studying seagrasses, which is a completely different ecosystem,
mm-hmm.
and her name is Sarah Lummis, and she's studying how aquaculture actually interacts with those seagrasses. So,
huh.
And then we have a new student named Ben Walker, and he is studying Dungeness crab. But this is his first year, so he's just getting started.
I wonder if he likes crab. Well, let's take a break here, and then I'm going to come back and talk about your radio show. Okay. This is KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. Tune in at 6 o'clock today after Sustainability Now for State of Mind, hosted by Santa Cruz licensed psychotherapist Deborah Sloss. Deborah's guests today are Anastasia Babulovich and psychotherapist Kara Bowman, LMFT. They'll discuss practical ways to cope with the profound impacts the COVID-19 outbreak is having on the community, especially those with mental health conditions. Anastasia shares how she and those she works with are experienced in dealing with fear of the virus, social isolation, and other challenging aspects of the pandemic. Psychotherapist Bowman offers helpful suggestions about the ways to support oneself and our loved ones during these unprecedented times. This show is aimed at those living with mental health challenges, but will also help anyone navigating the pandemic. Full of practical suggestions you can adopt right away, this show includes an extensive set of resources. So join us for new understandings and seeds of possibility on State of Mind this Sunday evening at 6 p.m. here on KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org, your ink spot on the radio dial. So, Emily is the producer of Santa Cruz Naturalist, which I mentioned airs three times a week. It actually airs on Tuesday mornings when I'm in here from 7 to 9 superintending the station. So I hear it. I'm curious how you go about, you know, how did you decide to do this? And how do you go about doing the interviews?
Yeah, so I started doing this. Almost a year before the station actually got started that I had heard that KSQD was coming about. And I was at this point in my PhD, which I think most PhD students experience, if not all, where I was like pretty disillusioned by academia, by my research. I was in like a pretty low place about it. And I had kind of forgotten why I even liked ecology at all. And it occurred to me that maybe doing a radio show would help me to remember what it is that I love about really the world, which is nature. It's like been it's this thing that's always there for you, even during times of isolation, such as what we're in now, yep. Where you can really get some perspective. And it's, yeah. It's, so I kind of have always loved radio. And I knew that Santa Cruz was a place that loves its, you know, its natural surroundings. I feel like most Santa Cruzians love to brag about how amazing the mountain biking, the surfing, and just generally pretty much everything about Santa Cruz is. But in particular, the nature. And so I thought it would be a really great place to kind of explore some untold stories about nature in and around Santa Cruz. And specifically, places and things like different critters that people could actually go out and see. So that's kind of why I started it, was just trying to potentially get people excited about being out in nature. And also in kind of selfishly to get myself more excited about science in a way again. So it started out with me thinking that I would be interviewing people from all over the place, but in reality I've been interviewing a lot of graduate students, in part because they don't get as many opportunities to talk about research. They can often be really enthusiastic, and a lot of their stories haven't quite been told yet because they're just like, you know, they're just learning this new thing about this thing that they are really excited about. So I've been interviewing a lot of grad students, as well as a lot of community members, specifically in some of the reserves and places like that, that have taken me out to see some really cool things. And I hope that that's come across in some of the episodes, because I feel like I've gotten some really amazing experiences and I've learned a lot about Santa Cruz and things that there are to see and do.
And these are being archived on the station website, right?
They are. Yeah, you can find most of them on the station, on the website. And actually, about, I'd say maybe 6 months ago, two other PhD students that are in my department that I had interviewed, they actually have come on board and are now producing their own monthly Santa Cruz Naturalists. So that's Theodora Block and Kelly Voss. So you will occasionally hear them as well.
What I find interesting in listening is the actual sort of interview, you know, how easily people will talk, or sometimes how you have to basically prompt them to talk. It's kind of, you know, it's sort of an interesting sort of technical problem.
It's definitely been an interesting experience coming from, and I imagine you probably have experienced this as well, Ronnie, coming from a science background or an academic background, then trying to kind of move into this role as a journalist reporter. It is a little bit of a learn. There is definitely, I don't think it comes natural to everyone.
No,
and it has certainly not to me. So it's a learning experience.
But
it's,
all these students, eventually they'll have to pitch their work to someone. So it's good practice. Well, we're going to listen to an episode of Santa Cruz Naturalist just so you can hear what it sounds like.
Okay. So this is one of my favorite ones. It's on mushrooms. And it's actually one of the first interviews that I did.
Welcome to Santa Cruz Naturalist. I'm Emily Downham. This week, we're exploring the forests of Aptos in search of mushrooms with local mushroom expert, Philip Carpenter. Here's Philip.
I've kind of been into mushrooms all my life. I have made it a lifelong thing to learn at least one new mushroom every year, but also try to remember it. Okay, that is the challenge.
Yeah,
it's in there. It's getting it back out. That's the question. So what we're going to do is walk across over there. So rather than get our feet wet in the grass. Right in this area we're growing some mushrooms earlier that I've been picking a lot of, called candy caps. It's a type of mushroom, believe it or not, that's used in making desserts.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm looking to see if I can find some candy caps.
So these things are so beautiful, and I feel like you see stuff like this all the time.
All the time, on deadwood.
Yeah, and it's absolutely just so beautiful.
Right. Well, there's a couple of different kinds, and I'm sure we'll see more. These are called turkey tails. That's a common name. Turkey tails, because it looks like a tail of a spread tom turkey.
Yeah.
This is Tremedes versicolor, and they're known to be quite medicinal. So this is one that you can chew up. And depending on the wood that it's on, it can be anywhere from really bitter to nicely mushroomy. Don't know what this one tastes like.
I didn't know we'd be
eating.
Tasting.
See, I find that pleasant. Some people don't.
So just so that listeners know what we were just looking at, these plates are almost a disc.
Yeah, they're
mushrooms.
They're called shelving.
Shelving
mushrooms.
Yep, and that totally makes sense.
Yep. Okay, you see that bump?
Yeah. Should we dig it up?
Absolutely.
Let's see what's under it. You know, it's funny, like I see these bumps all over in the redwoods.
Christmas time.
Yeah, it's like a present. Oh my God, it's beautiful.
That's the same as that.
It's just like totally untouched.
Yes.
Like a lot of the ones that we've been seeing that are out, it's like a newborn.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, let's walk back in here a little bit and see if we can. This is an area again that I found candy caps in the past. Ah, look what I found. These are candy caps.
Oh, it's definitely not what I was thinking they would look like.
Yeah, well, they are what they are.
Oh, wow. It's much smaller.
Very small.
And very hard to see.
Mm-hmm. There's two more.
Oh, yeah.
Now, it has a very unique aroma.
Let's give it a sniff.
The aroma, when fresh,
oh, wow,
is different than the aroma when they dried. The aroma, the compound that forms to give it its taste and aroma, forms during the drying process.
So, you know, we just had rain the past, you know, day and a half. Were these guys underground as a spore, and then they essentially have built that entire mushroom structure over that time period?
Well, the mycelium, the actual fungal organism, is called the mycelium, is under the ground. It's producing the mushrooms.
And so that's almost, can you think of it almost as like a big network of
tendrils? Exactly that. Looks like spider webs. But there's also mycelium from those guys, which are all over the place. So the competition going on underground is amazing.
Yeah, so, it's a battlefield.
It's a battlefield.
Listeners wanted to come out on a hike.
Right.
With you, what sort of opportunities might they have?
Well, probably the easiest way is through the Fungus Federation. So if you check the website, ffsc.us, there's local forays, long-distance forays, for a resource to help ID your mushrooms. Because, you know, if you go out and pick mushrooms that you want to eat, just make absolutely sure you know what they are. And if you think you know what they are and you're not quite sure, just don't eat it. You know, contact somebody in the Federation and have them verify your identification. Very important.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah.
My pleasure.
This was a blast.
Good.
Thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to Santa Cruz Naturalist. I'm Emily Downham, and my guest today was local mushroom expert Bill Carpenter.
Well, makes me want to go out and look for mushrooms now that we've just had a couple inches of rain.
I know, me too. Yeah. That was what I was thinking.
Yeah. Well, I'm not a mushroom hunter. My daughter is. Well, what haven't we covered? Is there anything that you might want to tell us that we haven't covered? Where can people find out more about urchins and kelp or something like that?
You know, the lab's website is a really good place. And unfortunately, I should have been more prepared for this. But I believe it's Christy-Croker.
Croker, right? K-R-O-E-K-E-R. Yeah, so you can look her up. And what's your website?
Mine is, I believe it's people, I can't remember. Well, can if you remember. Just Google
Emily Donham, D-O-N-H-A-M, and it's a wonderful website.
Thank you.
With some really nice photographs.
Yeah, I try to keep it current if I can. Yeah.
Well, it's been wonderful to actually learn about, you know, who you are, since you're here every week, other week helping me.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And I really encourage people to get outside, because we do have a really, really special place here in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, and there are lots of places which are really uncrowded, you know? I mean, everybody wants to go to the beach, and of course that's wonderful, but don't let the shut-in keep you shut in if you can find places to get out.
And do it safely.
Yes,
yeah, exactly.
That's for sure. Keep your distance. Well, 2 weeks from today, my guest will be Rachel Kippen, executive director of O'Neill Sea Odyssey and a columnist for the Santa Cruz Sentinel. We'll be talking about all things coastal and oceanic, a nice follow-up to today's show. So please join me on Sunday, April 19th, 5 to 6 p.m. right here on KSQD 90.7 FM on your dial or ksqd.org. And by the way, for those of you who cannot resist getting up before the sun rises these days, the station is rebroadcasting these Sunday shows, both mine and Be Bold America, on Tuesday mornings from 6 to 7 a.m. And if you've missed broadcasts, you can find them archived at tinyurl.com/RESD6JB. And I'm now posting them on the KSQD website as well. So, and if you have any comments or things you want to talk about, write to me at ronniel@ksqd.org. So until next every other Sunday, sustainability now.
How pleasant, bobbing along on the bottom of the beautiful briny sea. What a chance to get a better peep at the plants and creatures of the deep. We glide far below the rolling tide, serene through the bubbly blue and green. It's lovely bobbing along on the bottom of the beautiful briny sea.